Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Dan Buettner. Dan Buettner has discovered and researched the five places in the world which he calls blue zones, where people live the longest and are the healthiest. Dan is a National Geographic Fellow and New York Times bestselling author of many books, including his most recent, The Blue Zones Solution, Eating and Living Like the World's Healthiest People. His wildly popular articles have been featured in New York Times Sunday Magazine and on the cover of National Geographic. In 2009, working in partnership with AARP, Dan led the application of principles of the Blue Zones to the town of Albert Lea, Minnesota, and successfully raised quality of life while lowering healthcare costs by 40%. His program is now being implemented by municipal governments and insurance companies in more than 20 cities and has dramatically improved the health of more than 5 million people. You may have seen him on The Today Show, NBC Nightly News, Good Morning America, Dr. Oz, NPR, or Oprah. But you've never heard him in the Food Revolution Summit until now. So now, Dan, my dad and I are so grateful for your work and to have the opportunity to share your voice in this summit. And now for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean, and welcome, Dan.
Well, I'm honored to be here. I feel like I've spent a professional lifetime networking my way to this esteemed position, talking to the master himself.
Well, thank you. You know, we have some mutual friends, and one of them told me that you are one of the nicest and most down-to-earth people anyone could ever meet.
Well, I'm from Minnesota. You know, it's a land of bad hair and sensible shoes and small egos. So,
well, it's a privilege and it's a pleasure to have this conversation with you. Is it true? I have to get this out of the way. Is it true that you hold 3 Guinness Book of World Records for riding your bike across the world?
Yes. While you were doing useful and productive things with your life after college, I bike from Alaska to Argentina. It's 15,536 miles. I like to joke it was all downhill. Biked around the world through the Soviet Union with 2 Soviets, my brother Steve and I, and then I biked the length and width of Africa, which was 12,000 miles across the Sahara. And it was actually a very wonderful experience as a young man because you sort of learn empathy. And you learn self-sufficiency, and you learn to look at the world through the lens of underprivilege rather than the great privilege we have to live in this country.
Yeah, so often we fly over places and think we've seen them.
Yeah, I remember I got all the way to Africa, southern Africa, and met these villagers. And they asked me where I'd come from. I said, well, Algeria. And of course, they know I'm an American, and I explained to them I'd bike the whole way, and they kind of looked at me with this sort of bewildered expression on their face and finally said, why didn't you just fly? And I didn't have a good answer.
Well, I also heard that you didn't wear sunscreen when you were riding across the Sahara Desert. Is that true?
Yeah, it is true. It's a reflection of my lack of self-care sometimes, but you know, when you're biking on these bike rides, you everything you need to survive, you have to carry. You know, we cut our toothbrushes in half, and crossing the Sahara, about 500 miles of which had no roads, we went right through the middle of Algeria. We had to carry water, and so you start asking yourself, will this help me survive, or is this something nice to have? And sunscreen fell in a nice to have, but not essential. We carried up to about 35 liters of water. I lived off of mostly dates and dried milk at the time because that was portable. And we carried actually one of the very first GPSs and navigated across the Sahara with the GPS and then CIA maps called operational navigational charts, which would literally enable us to navigate from dune to dune and artesian well to artesian well, which probably was the difference of surviving or not surviving.
Well, I'm sure you have many, many, many astounding stories of your adventures. I somehow you went from that, from basically riding your bike across the entire globe, to getting funding from the National Institutes of Health and from National Geographic, and setting out to basically reverse engineer longevity. You worked with demographers, you identified famously five pockets around the world where people live the longest and the healthiest lives. And then you worked with anthropologists and epidemiologists and medical researchers to determine what they've been doing most of their lives that accounts for their extended and healthy longevity. And then you called these centers of longevity the Blue Zones. So for those of our listeners who aren't already familiar with the Blue Zones, where are they?
Well, the idea was to find the measurably longest lived area, and there's a couple ways to measure longevity, and we use mostly three, or we focus on three, and this is a simplification. Highest life expectancy, highest centenarian rate, so how many 100-year-olds per 10,000 people are there? And the best one is actually the rate of middle-age mortality, which essentially means when you're 40, what population has the best chance of reaching a healthy age 90 or 92. Again, that's a simplification, but it that last measurement filters out infant mortality and the mortality that comes at adolescence, usually with boys. So it's really a good, for those of us who are middle age and we want the best chance of 100, it's that lowest rate of middle age mortality that gives you the best chance. So the five areas, longest lived women in the world, Okinawa, Japan, longest lived men, the highlands of Sardinia, the Nuoro province specifically, a little bit in Oleostra. In Central America, it's the Nicoya Peninsula of Costa Rica. Our final blue zone we found off the coast of Turkey, it's the Greek island of Ikaria. And then in America here, we name the Loma Linda, the Seventh-day Adventist there, a blue zone. It follows a slightly different measurements, but adherent Adventists are living up to a decade longer than their North American counterparts, so we name them a blue zones as well.
Well, when a community develops a reputation for longevity, this draws tourists, and it's good for business. And I imagine the truth in some situations about how old people are can be difficult to nail down. How were you able to overcome these kinds of challenges and establish the facts about how old these people are and the area's actual longevity?
This is why it took 2.5 years to find these blue zones. Before we'll name a blue zone, we'll actually go there and verify ages. So we will take a random selection of centenarians and actually check their birth certificates, check their IDs, and actually show up at their house and ask them a number of questions to assure they're centenarians. And we've dug some dry wells. We spent a lot of time and money looking at the Vilcabamba Valley of Ecuador, which is previously, if you Google longevity or centenarians in South America, it often come up, but we completely debunked that area. The people there didn't even have reliable birth certificates, so you can be pretty sure they're overestimating their age.
Well, in our discussions around food in this culture, protein has a unique role, really an extraordinary role. And vegans and vegetarians are always being asked, where do you get your protein? You've written that on average, over the past 100 years, about 95% or 90% of the caloric intake in the blue zones has come from plants, and only maybe 5% or 10% has come from animal products. I want to ask you, Dan, do you think the extraordinary health and longevity in the blue zones has happened because of the emphasis on plant-based proteins or in spite of it?
It's hard to say. Again, the extent of my knowledge is what 100-year-olds have done to reach age 100. And I try to stay away from micronutrient opinions. But our Blue Zone solution took a meta-analysis of 155 dietary studies. I work with the University of Minnesota in all five Blue Zones over the last 100 years. So if you want to know what a 100-year-old ate to live to be 100, you can't just ask them what they're eating now and ask them to remember what they ate, because they can't remember. No more than you or I could remember what we had for lunch a week ago Tuesday. But there are fairly reliable dietary surveys that were done 80, 90, even 100 years ago in some of these places. So we aggregated them. And we're finding that, you know, somewhere between, on average, is between 90 and 100, but, you know, some of these populations that live a long time don't eat any meat. But on average, they're eating meat about five times a month. And to your question, do they live a long time because of that or in spite of it, we don't know. I mean, they were calorically restricted for periods along the way, and they just didn't have the option to run down to Costco and buy a crate of food, in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, et cetera. These are fairly remote areas, and they had to eat what they could grow or what they could raise. And, you know, you look at Icaria or the highlands of Sardinia, and it's this prickly terrain, and you can't grow crops. And, you know, they had to survive, so the only way to kind of aggregate calories was through their goats and their sheep. And, yes, they would butcher these animals, humanely and eat the meat. They probably needed the calories, but what we don't know is if they had the luxury of being able to eat just plant-based, like the Adventists do, if they might have even survived better and longer.
Well, you mentioned Icaria. There's the Icaria study, which involved a thorough look at the diet there, and found that it includes six times as many beans as Americans eat, and as you mentioned, far less meat. And apparently, it's not just Icaria. The high intake of beans seems to be one of the hallmarks of the Blue Zones. Was that an accurate statement?
Yes. Yes, and that's from looking at all these dietary studies and also our observations. My team guesses that they're eating on average about a cup of beans a day, cooked beans of one type or another. Now, they eat slightly different beans depending on where you are, but that's a cornerstone of every longevity diet in the world.
Well, if Americans could find a way to get a cup of beans into their daily diets, what do you think would happen to life expectancy here?
I'm extrapolating, but it would probably add 2 to 4 extra years of life expectancy. And there's a few reasons for that, John, because number one, and you know this, but beans are a great source of fiber and folate and protein, especially when combined with a grain. But they also kind of nurture healthy bacteria in the gut. And we're learning more and more on the importance of gut health, and some microbes fuel inflammation, other microbes actually help synthesize different vitamins, different nutrients we need. And beans tend to be a fodder or a mulch for good bacteria. And then finally, if you're, first of all, you know, according to the CDC, the average American eats about twice as much protein as they need. But if you're protein focused and you feel like you're getting your protein from that cup of beans and rice or the beans and the squash or corn tortillas, then you don't feel as compelled to tuck into a steak or a pork chop to get your perceived protein needs covered.
Well, if it's true that adding a cup of beans to our diets would add 2 to 4 years to our life expectancy, which, by the way, I think it would, I agree with you, then that would make beans a more miraculous food than many of the exotic superfoods that people spend so much money on.
Exactly. There is no question it's a superfood. You know, beans, when you grow them, it fixes nitrogen back into the soil. So it, instead of using up the soil It actually enriches the soil over time. They're cheap. They are very versatile. I come back to say one of the greatest secrets I brought back from Blue Zones is not what to eat, but how to make beans taste good. We don't know how to make beans taste good in this country, and there are fabulous ways to cook beans that, you know, if you took the sort of culinary ingenuity we pour into, you know, bone marrow and pork belly and put that on the beans, we'd be eating them all the time.
Well, you might end up being remembered as the guy that made beans cool.
I would die a happy man if people look back. If they enter cool beans into Google and my face shows up, I've been successful.
Well, I think that may be part of your legacy. I think there's a lot to your legacy that's still being developed, obviously, but you know what a lot of people think about getting old and being a centenarian, living to 100, it's not entirely appealing. In our country, half of the people who reach the age of 85 have dementia. Sometimes it's Alzheimer's, sometimes it's other forms, but they are losing their cognitive capabilities. And in some cases, literally losing their mind, literally losing their ability to remember who they are, who their loved ones are. And that is frightening to a lot of us. So in the Blue Zones, when you see people living to these extended lengths of time, these old ages, how are they doing cognitively? Are they experiencing dementia? Or are they lucid in ways that people that age here aren't?
Yeah, so you're familiar with the Icaria study. So that was done as a direct follow-up to our project identifying it. And a team out of University of Athens went and found every person on that island, or 95% of them so, who were over the age of 60, and administered the same cognitive test that the National Institutes on Aging uses to assess dementia, and found only 3 mild cases of dementia on the entire island. This is of 10,000 people. So extrapolating from that, there are 50% of 85-year-olds in this country suffering from dementia. It would be way less than 10% in Icaria. So these are people who are living a long time, 7 or 8 years longer than American, but more importantly, staying sharp to the very end. And I had dinner with the head of Cedar Sinai's dementia program, who told me that about 80% of dementia is avoidable in this country. The cornerstone, once again, is staying sharp to the very end, is probably getting as close as you can to a plant-based diet.
Well, one of the Blue Zones is in the United States, or mostly the Loma Linda Seventh-day Adventists, and they are among the most vegetarian or even vegan people in the world, I believe.
One of the best epidemiology studies in America is the Adventist Health Study 1 and 2, and that's followed about 100,000 Americans for 30 years. And all of them Adventists, and not all Adventists are vegan. Some eat meat, some are lacto-oval, so they'll eat cheese and eggs. Some are pescatarians. But when you follow that, when you retrospectively look at that study, the longest-lived Americans are either vegans or pesco vegetarians. In other words, they're vegans, but they might eat up to one piece of fish a day. That is fairly convincing. I think it's the most convincing body of evidence in America that point to the benefits of eating plant-based.
Well, the advocates of low-carb diets have a lot of people's ears today, and their books sell a lot, and people are listening to them. And they say that we should avoid wheat, that we should avoid other grains. What does your research into the Blue Zones tell you about that?
Well, one example is the paleo diet, but during Paleolithic times, life expectancy, even if that were correct, even if they correctly extrapolated the diet, some meat, they didn't eat meat, a lot of meat, because you know, they had an occasional kill, and they had no refrigeration, so they weren't keeping meat around the camp very long. But life expectancy in Paleolithic times was about somewhere between 26 and 30. So it might have been a diet that sort of optimized your chances of, you know, getting to the age of procreation. But if you want to be around till you're 70 or 80 or 90, it's probably a flawed premise. In blue zones, about 70% of the dietary intake came from complex carbohydrates.
With grains, I'm imagining they're eating a lot of bread. And I imagine it's typically sourdough bread.
Yes. In Icaria and in Sardinia, bread is a big cornerstone. But it's leavened not with yeast, but rather lactobacillus, which is a bacteria technically. And it takes a long time for the dough to raise, a day or two. But the process of leavening it with lactobacillus consumes almost all the gluten. It's got a fraction of the gluten that a regular loaf of bread would have. But also, and there's good research backing this up, that if you're eating a piece of or two of sourdough bread with your meal, it lowers the glycemic load of the entire meal by about 25%. So there's some good arguments there suggesting that sourdough bread with a meal is actually probably a pretty good idea.
Yeah, I remember you writing about visiting, I think having a meal with one of Icaria's few physicians, and he set a table with Kalamata olives and hummus and a heavy sourdough bread and wine. And that sounds delicious, but it definitely does not sound like the low-carb fare we often hear touted as the way to eat.
I think absolutely the right way to do it is to eat complex carbohydrates, and that should be two-thirds of your plate. There's every longevity diet in the world is the same way. So you look at Costa Rica. They're eating corn tortillas, squash, big carbohydrate, and beans. That's sort of Mesoamerica, three sisters, they call it. In Sardinia, it's bread and pastas, but there'll be some tomatoes and beans in there. In Icaria, it's potatoes and bread almost every meal, those two, but they'll have lots of beans and greens. And in Okinawa, until about 1960, the vast majority of their calories came from sweet potatoes, or they call them emo. They're slightly different than the sweet potatoes we eat here in America. They're purple. But, you know, think about it. That we look at that as a carb bomb, but actually it has a pretty low glycemic index number. And, they're protein in all of these places other than plant proteins. Meat protein was a celebratory food or a flavoring, but you never see this idea that, you know, I want to get healthy, I'm going to go eat a steak.
And I imagine there's no processed food. You know, 62% of the calories in the American diet today come from ultra-processed foods. And those foods are full of sugar and chemicals and things that didn't exist in the food supply until recently, and I'm sure aren't in the food supply in the blue zones.
They haven't been traditionally, but sadly, the American food diet is hitting these places like a tsunami. Okinawa will probably lose its status as a blue zone pretty soon, if not already, because of the onslaught. And in Nicoya, the city of Nicoya, they just got a Burger King recently.
Oh.
So it's sad to see.
It is.
But at least we captured it. You know, at least we know that for this slice of time, that here's a way of eating that could yield 100 good years.
Yes, and then it's up to us how we translate that into our lives here. I remember reading that that you wrote that in the blue zones, people drink a lot of water. They drink herbal teas, sometimes black teas, and coffee. shows up in many of them, and red wine. And I thought, well, if somebody has a problem or has had a problem with alcohol, they obviously need to avoid it, and we should totally support them in that. But for the rest of us, those of us who are able to tolerate it and consume it moderately, are there secrets to consuming red wine that enhances the health-giving properties?
Yes. We found one wine we thought was interesting, a Cannonau wine. It's made from a Grenache grape. That's not a brand. It's a varietal up in the Highlands. Had three times the level of polyphenols, and it could just be a coincidence, but that's the wine they drink. They tend to low dose it all day long, a couple ounces in the morning, a couple ounces with lunch, a couple ounces with their friends after work, maybe a little bit more at dinner, but not, you know, not a big goblet they gulp down. If you're drinking wine with the Mediterranean diet or a plant-based diet, you can about triple the uptake or the absorptions of some nutrients. You know, there's an argument to be made that a small glass of wine with a meal is better than a glass of water with a meal, the right kind of meal. That doesn't work with a steak, by the way.
And why is that?
Well, because steaks don't possess the nutrients that wine helps you absorb.
I see.
And then, of course, you know, it's a social lubricant. And if you're if you relieve your stress while you're eating, digestion of your food goes more smoothly. Cortisol interferes, that hormone that your body excretes when you're in a hurry or you're worried or existentially stressed out. That tends to ameliorate when you're having a glass of wine with some friends. And so, like, as you point out, if you don't have a problem with alcohol, you should go ahead.
Yeah. You know, speaking of things that people drink in the Blue Zones, in some of them, at least, they have goats, and they're free roaming goats. They're not factory farmed. They're not confined. And the folks often make fermented products like yogurt or cheese from the goat's milk. And I think that those products are very, very, very different and probably a lot more healthful than the processed dairy products that we see in supermarkets in the United States, for example.
Yes, I think so. I believe so. You look at what pigs in Sardinia are eating, and they're kind of free-range pigs. They're eating acorns and scraps from dinner. They're not being, you know, fed corn. The same with chickens and the goats and the sheep range widely, and they're eating all these wonderful herbal sage-like plants that they can find. They're pastured over many miles. But I think, when it comes to cheeses, the Pecorino, a Sardinian cheese or Icarian feta cheese is very rich. You take a piece of cheese the size of an ice cube and you're satisfied with that. That flavoring goes a long way. It's not like mozzarella where you got to slather a quarter of a pound it to get satisfaction from it. So it's not only the nutrient quality of the product, it's probably also the fact that they're not eating a lot of it.
Yeah, well, we have a toxic food culture, right? When you think about cheese or mozzarella, I think of the pizzas that are just slathered in cheese, and it's high salt cheese, and it's from cows who've been treated like crap. I mean, all of their natural instincts have been violated. Their natural urges have been frustrated. It's a nightmare. And in the United States, really in much of the modern world, you can't go to a movie, you can't walk through an airport or a grocery store without being routed through a gauntlet of candy bars and salty snacks and sugar-sweetened beverages. McDonald's spends $1 billion a year on advertising, much of which is aimed directly at kids. So, Dan, you live in the modern world. How do you personally combat those influences, and how has your study of the Blue Zones affected and changed your life in the United States?
Well, first of all, I'll say if you're unhealthy and overweight in this country, I say it's probably not your fault. I mean, our obesity rates almost quadrupled since the 60s. We have a toxic environment, and you start to see you just cannot avoid crappy foods. Most of my work these days, I work with Blue Cross Blue Shield plans and ShareCare and Texas health systems to try to actually reshape environments so that the healthier choice is easy. In these blue zones, you know, people tend to think, oh yeah, these are disciplined 100-year-olds who, you know, got their exercise and ate plants because they wanted to. No, the fact of the matter is these people didn't have a clue that what they were doing was going to lead to a long life. They never tried to live a long time. Their longevity, and again, these are heterogeneous populations. These are melting pots of people. They don't have any dietary plan. They don't necessarily have better genes than we do. They just have better environments. So the secret to a healthier America, in my opinion, is not trying to modify individuals' behavior or scold them or guilt them or give them, you know, a free T-shirt for eating their veggies. It's taking aim at our environment and making the healthy choice easier or unavoidable.
Well, that's what you're doing when you the Blue Zones Project, for example, partners with the Beach Cities Health District in Southern California. I know you've done that to apply Blue Zones principles to Redondo Beach and Hermosa Beach and Manhattan Beach. In 2 years after the Blue Zones Project team started working there, those cities saw a 14% drop in obesity and a 30% decrease in smoking rates. Those are powerful statistics. How did that happen?
That's held, by the way. It's now 5 years, and the average BMI is down about 17%, and that's against California controls. In other words, not all of California has seen that. And our biggest win is childhood obesity is down by 50%.
Oh my God, that is fantastic.
And it works, and the approach is to get every single school. We got about 100 restaurants to get Blue Zone certified so that there's a plant-based option, and you don't automatically get bread and butter when you sit down. You have to ask for it. You have to pay for refills of soda. There's an option to get smaller desserts. In schools, we've applied simple techniques. We learned most of them from Brian Wansink, who's our food director, but you put fruits and vegetables at the beginning of the line because kids tend to, we disguise healthy food to look like junk food, so there's these beautiful parfaits, but they're really just sliced fruits. We'll give them baked potato fries, which instead of French fries, not the best, but better than what they normally have. Taken out all of the soda machines from these schools. And they've also begun to change food policies. We convinced them to create a 1,000-foot perimeter around schools where there are no concession stands and no food trucks that are generally not all that healthy, to try to remove the temptations to get, run out and get junk food when the cafeteria is trying to do its best to offer healthy foods.
That's outstanding. Outstanding. I know that you've worked in Iowa with the whole state, really. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So Wellmark, the Blue Cross Blue Shield plan, and the governor of Iowa, Wellmark funded it, and the governor, Terry Branstad, endorsed it and gave us 5 years. We auditioned 90 cities and picked 15. In order for it to work, you have to have a city that really wants it because it requires the buy-in of the mayor and the city manager and the city council and the chamber of commerce and the big CEOs, public and private. And we usually only have 3 years to get our work done. And typically what we try to do is permanently change the environment. We don't spend money on advertising and free giveaways and fun runs and veggie programs. We just make the healthy choice easier. And they've made some incredible you know, simple things like changing the ordinances so that it's okay for people to have gardens in their yards. It's okay to establish a farmer's market. In most of these cities, we've been able to put two or three community gardens in, which begins to change the culture. And in every city, we've seen obesity drops, and we've seen well-being rise, smoking rates dropping. But it's one of these things where it takes a year or two to implement, and then the bun's got to bake before you start seeing it show up in the data. And the reason we have the best data from the beach cities is because we're going on year six with them.
Well, those are cities, and Iowa's a state. And it strikes me that getting these kinds of results statewide would be an even more daunting task. There is something called the Well-Being Index that ranks states. And has Iowa shown improvements as a state?
Yeah, so that's Gallup. Gallup Healthways, WBI, Well-Being Index. And they were 15th in this well-being. So the ranking measures not only your physical health, but also your emotional health and your work health, and then your overall life satisfaction. And when we started, Iowa was 15th, and I think the study you're citing, they were up to 9th. I don't know what they are yet this year. That comes out in January. So they went up, and we're, you know, there are 900 cities in Iowa, but most of them have fewer than 1,000 people. We're in the 15 of the biggest cities, and probably most of the population comes under our sway. But we haven't taken on statewide policies yet, except a little bit with the Department of Transportation to try to get people walking more. But mostly what we try to do, our first phase set out to show that cities could do it. And then once you get precedence, it's a lot easier to sell it to neighboring cities. And then once it works and you measure it, then it's easier to take it to the state level. And we're getting most of our pickup with that with HMSA in Hawaii, where they've taken on a much more ambitious statewide Blue Zone project. And it's newer, but it's more ambitious.
In what ways is it more ambitious?
Well, because most of the city laws are really island-wide laws, so we're able to go in at a, you know, nearly a state level with our interventions there, our food policy interventions. In fact, not just Waimea, but they affect the entire island, and indeed sometimes the entire state. It's just the way the legislative process works there. Local government works there.
Well, it's very exciting news that you're reporting, and it bodes well. This is not happening just on the left coast. It's in Iowa. It's throughout the country in different places. You mentioned in Iowa, you're working with Wellmark, Blue Cross, Blue Shield. What's it like working with insurance companies? Do you ever have to, I mean, you're collaborating with them. Is there any danger of being co-opted, of having other agendas sneak in that are not really yours?
I don't think so. So the type of insurance companies that tend to embrace us, and also hospital systems like Texas Health System, they're accountable. So Texas Health System, for example, they insure a population of people, and they're responsible for them from cradle to grave. And if we can create a blue zone and drive down the cost of health care over by 15 or 20%, that's going to go right to their bottom line. So I think our agendas align. Blue Cross Blue Shield is a pretty wonderful organization because most of them are not-for-profit. So in Iowa and in Hawaii, they're not trying to maximize shareholder value. Their profits are held at under 5%. And everything else they make, they have to plow back in or they have to rebate. So they're not there trying to maximize profit. They're one of these insurance companies that really are focused on making people healthier, because there's no upside to trying to make more money.
That's great. You know, if an insurance company is profiting from a percentage of the of healthcare costs, they actually have an incentive that healthcare costs grow.
Yeah, a lot of insurance companies, and not the ones I work with, are really kind of like banks. They're agnostic as to whether health costs grow, because they'll just get increase the rates.
Yeah.
But what's happening in the United States is rates are so high that they realize that people can't pay them anymore. That's why there's such a crisis in the country. About 85% of all health care costs are directly attributable to chronic disease, almost all of which is avoidable, and $3 trillion of our GDP. So these CEOs of insurance companies realize that they're going to lose their market. People simply aren't going to be able to pay premiums at all unless they're part of the solution to getting people healthier. So there has been, and I talked to a lot of these insurance companies, there has been a real shift towards in part of healthcare companies away from just making sick people less sick and helping them stay healthy in the first place.
Well, this is the shift from disease management to genuine healthcare and prevention and wellness enhancement. I'm thrilled.
Right. And, you know, once again, you can't fault them. You know, we live in a capitalist society, and every industry has a right to try to make, free enterprise, right? So, but the problem is our whole system's set up on nobody makes money unless you get sick. So insurance company will put aside, but the a doctor doesn't make money unless you show up for an office visit or a test, and a hospital doesn't make money unless you show up and rent a bed and use the services, and a pharmaceutical company doesn't make money unless you get sick and get a prescription. And we've learned a long time ago the folly of hoping, incenting for A and hoping for B. You know, so in this, the system incents for sickness, yet we hope for health. And in countries where, you know, like Costa Rica, which I study, that has about half the rate of middle-aged mortality, their healthcare system is completely incented for health. Everybody who works for it is incented for health. Nobody makes money in that system if people get sick. So lo and behold, you see a pretty good alignment of incentives and outcomes.
You write about the Nicoya Peninsula in Costa Rica, where you found the population there reaches the age of 90 at a rate 2.5 times greater than we do in the United States. And they do so while spending about a tenth the amount that we do on healthcare.
Yeah, it's actually about a 15th. Spend a lot of that on public health. So reaching people before they get sick rather than before it's a 3-alarm fire in an emergency room, so to speak.
You know, so many of our bad habits are contagious. You know, the studies show that if your friends are obese, you are much more likely to be obese, even more so than if your parents are obese. And if your friends' friends are obese, you're more likely to be obese. It's these bad habits really do spread like a social contagion. And it sounds like part of the secret of the Blue Zones and part of the secret of the projects inspired by the Blue Zones that you're implementing here in the United States is you're making positive and healthful social contagions. You're putting them into circulation.
Right. So we took a page from the Okinawan Blue Zone. There's a construct known as a MOAI, M-O-A-I, which is a committed social network. We saw this. I sat with 100-year-olds, 500-year-olds who belonged to the same social little network, this friends group, and they all eat, you know, tofu and stir-fried and miso, and they watch out for each other and take walks together and they garden together, you know, to this idea of contagions. So in our Blue Zone projects, we spend a lot of time and effort, and they work incredibly well. We put the word out to a city that Blue Zones is coming. If you'd like to join, show up. We usually get 300 or 400 people to show up, and we try to center these in school auditoriums. We take about an hour to let people get to know each other, and then we challenge them. We let them break up into groups of five, people with liked values and interests and schedules. And then we challenge them to eat a Blue Zones diet, to host. So five people in each Moai, each one host one potluck dinner at their house. But the rules are it's plant-based. We have these Blue Zones food guidelines, which lays out very clearly what you can include and what you don't. And that's amazingly powerful because a lot of people in America have never even tasted good plant-based food. They have to know they like it. They have to have the skills to make it, and they have to have a social network where it's easy to eat it. And this Moai hits on all three of those pistons. And we find that when we create these Moais and people, you know, are hanging out together for 10 weeks sporadically, about 60% of the people in these Moais stay together for the long run. So we have a permanent construct that keeps people, you know, in the system, so to speak, without, you know, having to pay them or check up on them. It's the attraction of friends.
Well, you're reducing loneliness. You're providing people with social support. You're, I'm sure, lowering rates of depression and dependence on all kinds of pharmaceutical drugs that otherwise escalate as people age in this country. I'm really amazed at how you've gone from a riding your bike everywhere, sometimes without sunscreen, and carrying your water across the Sahara Desert, to investigating very thoroughly, with great discipline, where in the world, in fact, people are living the longest and healthy lives, which is a remarkable feat to really nail that down. And then to translate that into these programs that are doing so much good in the United States and in the modern world and in the Western world, where so much of these ills are actually emanating from globally. I'm very impressed and thrilled that you, with your work, and very grateful to you, Dan, for being part of our work in the Food Revolution Network.
Well, thank you, but I don't want to disappoint you because I still ride my bike.
Good.
Oh, that was very kind. Thank you. And it's an honor to talk to you one-on-one, and I'm a huge admirer of your work, and I'm very happy to be part of the conversation here. So.
Well, you most certainly are. We're very, very grateful to have you.
We sure are. We've been talking here with National Geographic fellow Dan Buettner, New York Times bestselling author of The Blue Zones and The Blue Zone Solution. You know, Dan, you've conducted colossal research around the globe, and now you're applying brilliant strategy that's helping people and communities to implement your discoveries. And in this process, you are transforming millions of lives. And I think that your work is one of the most hopeful and inspiring developments in the food world today. We are so grateful for your work, for your research, for your insights, for your leadership, and for your partnership in the food revolution.
I'm humbled. Thank you very much. You guys are great.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and you want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 24 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then check this out. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus ebooks, courses, trainings, recipes, and videos. And this empowerment package is available for a huge 50% discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us in the Food Revolution.